welcome to this episode of Military History Inside Out.
I'm speaking with Natalie Cazal, author of Pretty Liar, Television, Language, and Gender in Wartime Lebanon. Thank you for speaking with me.
Thank you for having me, Chris. I really appreciate this opportunity.
Oh, sure. So first, how did you get into studying and writing on this subject?
I rented a Lebanese sitcom, believe it or not, called My Aunt's Home from a DVD rental in Orange County in California when I was in grad school. And so the show was about a group of characters that took language, private language lessons with a teacher who lived in his aunt's home. So that's why it's called My Aunt's Home. It was one of the most popular shows during the 1975-1991 Civil War in Lebanon. And people really loved the characters of this show so much that one of the child actors, whose real name was Carl, he was called in school by the name of the character he played, Samir, and even his teachers forgot his real name. And that became something of a kind of a interesting incident in the press commented on it. So why did this show intrigue me? The scenes that first caught my attention spoke to me personally because at the time I was teaching Arabic at UCLA and I saw the scenes that were about teaching Arabic and learning Arabic. And so that personally kind of intrigued me. They were about kind of a failure of this Arabic teacher to teach his students Arabic. And they really never learned the language. So if you think of it, this is the exact opposite of the famous song from the American musical My Fair Lady. And on that musical there is this this kind of a song which says Arabians learn Arabian with the speed of summer lightning. Why can't we, the English, learn to speak? And so this is like the exact opposite. So I found myself to to kind of be attracted to some of the portrayals on the sitcom because they were unexpected and also thought-provoking. For example, the conventions of the genre of sitcom tell us that if there is a language teacher, then his students will have to have poor language skills so that the sitcom would continue on and on, right? He can't just like resolve the problem and everything is fine. And they also, if they don't have good language skills, they can't climb the social ladder since, you know, this is kind of educational, capital that they have. And that particular formula was very similar to a British sitcom called Mind Your Language from the 1970s that mocked the idealization of language in My Fair Lady and Pygmalion, because My Fair Lady is kind of an adaptation of Pygmalion. But the Arabic sitcom that I watched, My Aunt's Home, the students actually got social prestige without any good language skills. They didn't need to really learn the language to climb the social ladder. Actually, the teacher worked, the private teacher, he worked as a waiter in a restaurant to make ends meet, but his students, one of them was the most famous Lebanese historical actor. That's the character, respected by everybody. And the other later became a glamorous TV show host. So you see, like, what is, the difference here? I actually liked it because it was a kind of a show that kind of stayed away from academic mumbo-jumbo and moralistic lessons. You know, you didn't kind of try to sell these. And that made it a very good representative of a whole class of cultural products during the Lebanese Civil War that involved mostly literature and other kind of cultural genres in which people, writers and poets, they had a kind of love and hate relationship with language. Or I should say not love and hate, but they had kind of an attitude of pessimism. On one hand, they were really disappointed with language because it could not, especially standard formal language, because it couldn't portray their experience. And on the other hand, they really created a viable Lebanese version of Arabic language. And so they had kind of this relationship. And so I found that there was a whole group of Lebanese sitcoms after I watched this one, a drama series, television series from the war that focused on learning language. But ultimately, my aunt's home was a good gateway into my research because it mocked what I call the peace bubble.
Hmm. So before we talk about the book, tell us a little bit about the Lebanese Civil War, or at least what you understand about it, just to give a backdrop of what you studied.
Yeah, the Lebanese Civil War started in 1975, and it ended in 1991. So it was about 16, 17 years of war. And this was not a continuous conflict. It actually was a series of different conflicts that happened with different factions in the Lebanese Civil War. And these factions constantly rearticulated their interests, and they allied with former enemies, or they became enemies with former allies. A watershed moment in the war was 1982, when the Israeli army invaded and laid siege to Beirut. And one of the famous things about the Lebanese Civil War is that it actually started with a bus incident when a crowd of Palestinians were coming out from kind of an event, and they were very happy on a bus, and they passed by an area in which previously there was a shooting. And so the people in that area, that was kind of a Christian congregation there, thought that the Palestinians were responsible. So they kind of killed the people on the bus. And that's how the war started. Eventually, over 100,000 people were reported to have died in the war, and there were multiple other casualties. But the Lebanese economy, because it had a strong kind of black market, black economy, alternative economy, it survived, even though it cut down the standards of living from the pre-war standards significantly.
Was there specific parts of Lebanon that maybe suffered from the war more than others? And I ask that because I'm wondering, as you did your research, you know, which cultural groups affected the change that you saw, you know, if they were impacted by the war and caused the change that you studied.
Yeah, Beirut was basically the center of most of these activities. And some of the places that were outside of Beirut did have also conflicts. And a lot of the population in different areas was displaced throughout the country, including by the Israeli occupation of the south of Lebanon. But the center of the war was definitely the capital, Beirut. Mm-hmm. At one point in the war, in the beginning of the first 2 years of the war, the so-called the two-year war, Beirut was... It was a vibrant, it had the image of a vibrant cosmopolitan city that accepted tourists, was, you know, first among the Arab countries, basically translated the innovations of the world to the rest of the Arab countries. That's how it understood itself. Mm-hmm. But during these first 2 years of the war, the population, The militias on the two sides, on the two main sides, were, one was the Christian coalitions and the other were the leftist parties and other groups. They kind of exchanged the population, and so Beirut became a capital divided by religion, whereas before it was more or less mixed. Mm-hmm. Now there was this kind of a cleansing, and so a tremendous number of people were displaced from their apartments, and they went and they actually occupied apartments which had been left by people who went the other way. So that has been a significant problem for the Lebanese, society, this displacement, these kind of apartments, and the fact that it became a lot more sectarian even after the end of the war. Mm-hmm. Because of these dynamics.
So it seemed like there were a lot of sort of external actors as well on this, you know, other nations, and also I imagine the people of Beirut were probably more cosmopolitan, and they, you know, they were displaced from their friends, you know, their social networks, you know, by people coming in from the outside and saying, you're not going to live here anymore, or whatnot. You know, it's artificial adjustment of their society.
You're right. It was not just a Lebanese war. A lot of people do have the image of Lebanon as a site where other powers were basically fighting their own conflicts, including the United States and the Palestinians and Syria and Israel and the Arab, other Arab countries. To such a degree, this is a belief in Lebanese society that they have a special term for it. It's called the War of Others. So it was not, you know, like our war, but it was a war of others. And that, in a way, is partially true, and partially it kind of displaces the blame. It puts the blame away from the people.
Okay, so now let's talk about the book. How did you? How does it break down? How are the chapters? You know, tell me about it.
Yeah, so the book basically talks about half of the book talks about news television, and the other half talks about these shows, these group of shows that I told you about, which portray the Lebanese trying to learn Arabic language. So there is a bunch of shows that I analyze there. And basically the conversation there is about language, its value, and what it does to society. The first part of the book is about news television, and especially about what I call the peace bubble. So the peace bubble is kind of it's a response. It's the response of Lebanese television to war, especially to the pressures of the war. When the war broke out, people started demanding a lot of news coverage because they wanted to protect themselves from the hostilities outside. And as a result, 43% of television started doing programs associated in one way or another with news. However, politicians very frequently accuse television of actually fanning the fires of the war, and not what they said, presenting a calming depictions that would save national unity. So television, despite these accusations, actually, the reality was much different, was more complex, because oftentimes journalists on television, they didn't really portray all the events and all the hostilities in the war. They sanitized some of the coverage. They included some other coverage. And they had, like, there was a number of different reasons for that, including technical failures because of the hostilities, including and very importantly, the fact that television journalists feared not to make matters worse, so they didn't want to engage too much in the conflict on the news. And when they did talk about the news, the local news, the news was late or evasive. Or they talked a lot about international news and other wars, like the war in Vietnam was a popular alternative. Or they had soft news that was not related to the war, and that's a kind of a self-muzzling, which is a very common dilemma. It introduces a very common dilemma in journalism and in media, just in general, during times of war. So either to tell the truth about the death toll, about all the destruction and all it does to the country, or to stick to a national rhetoric that covers up some of that toll, some of the costs of the war, in the hopes of maintaining a kind of a social and national unity so that they don't anger any of the warring sides and make matters worse. So there are multiple reasons why television created a kind of a television peace bubble.
So which sides were, who controlled the stations that were putting out these programs? Who was producing them? Was each side doing it, or how did that break down?
There were, in the beginning of the war, Lebanon had two television stations. And it is a country, unlike other Arab countries, where television was launched as a commercial enterprise. So it had two commercial stations. In other Arab countries, television was launched as a government enterprise. So they have been bickering since the beginning, since the late 1950s and early 60s. In 75, they were at a tremendously they were at a place where television was booming. Once the war started, they experienced a lot of problems. There were snipers out, and they couldn't go and do shoots. Couldn't shoot films outside. The news suddenly became a very hotly disputed area, and they couldn't portray all the news because of the reasons that I just said. Sometimes there were damage on their stations. And as a result, just 2 years into the war, by 1977, both of them were about to go bankrupt. So at this point, the Lebanese government had to save television, more so because the incoming new president-elect didn't want to be called the president who killed television. Yeah. So the government bought 50% of the shares of these televisions, two stations, and basically merged them into one station called Télé Liban, the television of Lebanon. They used, or in Arabic, Télévision Lebanon. So at this point, television was kind of a half commercial and half government enterprise. And the two branches preserved some kind of independence, but they also were very eager to get sometimes out of television news so that they don't have to respond to criticisms. That didn't work out very well, and at some point they were invaded by factions that were warring against each other, and so we see a lot of hijinks, a lot of accusations on television. So we see some kind of a spike in the coverage in which the two television stations participated in kind of a cultural war. But they didn't introduce a lot of actual complete non-evasive coverage of the news during that time. And so the bubble persisted. The bubble became even stronger. And to give you one example to make it less abstract, the most notorious, probably the most notorious example of that peace bubble was during the Israeli siege of Beirut. So when the siege started, on the same day the siege started, and mind you, the Israeli invasion is considered arguably the most traumatic experience in Lebanese recent history. So on the day that the Lebanese army started the siege of Beirut, and there were, you know, power blackouts, there were destructions, carpet bombings, etc., Télé Liban started a live coverage of the FIFA Soccer Cup in Spain. And that was the most spectacular cup ever. And so the Lebanese, in order to watch the cup, and they didn't have power, they went outside, the men went outside and connected their TV sets. They brought them out and connected them to their car batteries. And so these, like, pictures of these men watching television while the capital is involved in some kind of an inferno made it all through the international newspapers. And then this nonchalance just stunned the whole world. And some people believe that this was treason on the part of Lebanon, on the part of Télé Liban, the national station. But some argue that, well, even if it was treason, it was worth it. So this example basically tells us how the peace bubble basically brought a lot of, you know, talking about the peace bubble basically brings out a lot of questions regarding television's duty during times of war. Specifically, what is the What should the modern television look like, especially during times of war? How should it relate to the audiences? Does it have the duty to portray and process publicly the trauma that the population is going through? And what is the role of the modern audiences? Mm-hmm. And so all of that really illustrates basically the peace bubble. When I started piecing it, out, I started realizing that there is a lot of content here, and I can write a whole story about how the war really put pressure on television and on the relationship between television and audiences, and how that changed and what happened during that change.
Mm-hmm. Now, what about the language and gender parts of the book title?
Mm-hmm. The language and gender parts. So there is two themes of the book. The first theme is how the peace bubble on the news and entertainment television, how it was maintained. And there is language and gender components in that. And then the second main theme of the book is what were the responses to that bubble, especially by the audiences and also by kind of pirate television that was not sanctioned or licensed by the government. Mm. So when this happened, there was a shift in the relationship, which was very dysfunctional and disengaged between Tele Liban and the audiences. And at one point in 1985, there was this new pirate station called LBC that was launched, and basically it interfered in this relationship, and there was kind of a triangle between the audiences and the two stations, and they and that shifted the way television related to the audiences. Now, how do I investigate? How do I analyze this? How do I measure it? I look at language and gender. Mm-hmm. What kind of a story does that tell? Well, first of all, when you look at how Tele Liban, or the first side of this triangle, how it created and perpetuated this television peace bubble, there is a lot to say about language and gender. For example, there were particular protocols, gender protocols on television anchors that they had to follow one way or another. For instance, the anchors were considered to be the agents of that peace bubble, because they were, you know, they were basically the gateway, or they were shaping the information that was coming out to the public. Mm-hmm. And so to reinforce the bubble, they were advised, for example, the female anchors were given very ambiguous advice. For example, they were shamed because they spent 3/4 of their income for clothes and hair and makeup. But at the same time, immediately they were given the advice how to hook up the audiences, how to keep them engaged. And the advice is like, never appear in the same outfit twice in a row. So this is the exact contradictory advice. And you see how the outside appearance of anchors really made a difference in maintaining the peace bubble. So when the anchors were dressed well, when their hair and makeup was done, that gave the impression of to the audiences that they were very calm, and then nothing was happening. And so the audiences shouldn't really care about these things, and television could not involve itself, did not have to involve itself supplying good, complete coverage of the war. Another sexual or gender dynamic was, for example, with performance. The television audiences, when they were looking at anchors, they could size up from their behavior, from their performance, they could size up what kind of a trouble emotionally the anchor was feeling, and to infer from that what was the danger outside of the studio, because the anchor knew the news better than they knew the news. For example, if an anchor was reading too slowly, she appeared to be afraid of something, and that was a big no-no. If she was reading too fast, she reminded the audiences that, reminded them of a machine gun that wouldn't stop until the magazine was completely empty. And so these dynamics really played out. And I want to read you actually a passage where you can see the gendered protocols specifically of these dynamics.
Sure.
Okay, so this passage, I'll comment on it after that. Women's voices can be heard, seen, touched, smelled, and tasted. If you are a man of good taste, this voice is like a silk garment that covers her body, yet hides none of its parts. That woman is calling you. Her words are saying, oh baby, but her tone is telling you, I am a liar. She leads you into the bedroom without the slightest embarrassment from watching eyes. It's a voice that undresses its owner in preparation for announcing the latest news. You think that this other voice is reading the news to you, but its owner's head is down and her legs are up and her dress is new. Her voice isn't actually reading news. It complains how her husband ran away with an uglier friend. This new anchor is telling you about her passion for charity, but during this talking charade, her voice convinces you that she's just saying, I want a groom. So basically this quote shows you how women, or the women anchors and broadcasters on television, how they were perceived and sexualized to an extreme point, where this is a very misogynist account talking about them, and how television really used that dynamic to create a female broadcaster and a male viewer dynamic, and to keep basically the male audiences distracted from the news that it failed to present to them. So this is one of the gender dynamics here used. So using the male gaze, enticing the male gaze, and eschewing all the non-euphemistic coverage of the war became one of the protocols of television. And basically, as this quote shows, the recipe came down to lying. Her voice her words are saying one thing, but her voice and her behavior is saying something completely different. Hmm. Another component, specifically with language, was that language, the anchors were not just measured by their outside appearance and their performance, but also by their culture. People and the periodicals, etc., talked about this culture, and the culture, basically, they understood it to mean language, especially how they pronounce the standard Arabic language. On one hand, the Lebanese audiences really were very happy when anchors occasionally slipped in a Lebanese dialect expression or a whole sentence. On the other hand, the local press, especially the intellectuals, never missed a chance to critique television because the anchors were really awful in pronouncing and reading out loud the standard Arabic, and they made a lot of mistakes. One actually popular magazine, a cultural magazine, started a whole section, and it ran weekly for 8 months. In this particular section, the writers talked about how anchors should improve their language, and they were giving them grammar lessons about how to pronounce and how to use the vocabulary. And that was both language and gender specific section, because the person who wrote this kind of a column said that he is going to provide evidence that would turn faces red, yellow, and green because of the mistakes they made, but he vowed to only talk about the mistakes that female anchors made And he said their male counterparts, they make probably more mistakes, but I want to teach them by proxy. So you see how this gender dynamic again really plays out in this component of television that is related to language. At one point, the popular press even criticized anchors for launching what they call the language IBM, Intercontinental Ballistic Missile. Every time they open their mouth, they say something that is linguistically wrong. And if they didn't stop this, you know, the father, the legendary father of Arabic linguistics called Sibawayhi, he will rise from the dead. He will rise from the grave and he will come to abduct them. So, you know, they advised them to spend a little bit of their income to go buy themselves a grammar book and study it, or to pay for grammar lessons. You know, these were a lot of, criticisms launched at them. But basically, collectively, the appearance, the performance, and the language, the culture portrayed television as a pretty liar, because it tried to sell and distract, sell a pretty image. And, you know, represented by the anchors, and at the same time distract the television audiences from what was going on and from the failure of television to really respond and process the trauma of the population publicly.
Did radio inform any of your research, any of the radio that they had access to, radio programs?
I was focused on television a little bit. I commented in my book on radio because there was specifically one example of radio that was always given when it came to the media, especially television and lying, since oftentimes television was accused of lying to the public. This example of somebody called Sherif Al-Akhawi, and he was a teacher who at one point, before the war, started working on radio, in a show that basically dealt with kind of a traffic report. You know, it dealt with these kinds of, programs. Once the war started, he became an advocate for the Lebanese population, because the primary concern of these people were to know in what particular area of the capital or the country there was a skirmish, or there were hostilities, or if they could go, if they went out, they didn't want to be shot by a sniper, or to find themselves in the middle of some kind of a hellish battle. And so what he did was he accepted phone calls from the public, and the public informed him, in such and such an area there is a battle, please, you know, stay away. And so he would constantly inform the public about these things, which television never did. And so he was praised as the hero of Lebanese, of the Lebanese audiences, of Lebanese public. Even, you know, he became internationally famous. To this day, he's held to a very high standard, as an icon from the war. And even, I think, Jerusalem Post, the newspaper Jerusalem Post, suggested that he would be given a Nobel Prize for what he did for the population. So he was ultimately, a few years afterwards, he suffered several abduction attempts, and some of the militias raided his station, and he couldn't continue this program, so he got out of it. But he never ceased to represent this ultimate image of the responsible newscaster or media person.
Now, how much access did Lebanese people have to, I guess during that period, cable was developed, cable television, near the end. I have no idea what they had access to.
Well, cable television came to the Arab world in general, even though some earlier attempts were, you know, started to be designed earlier, but it came in a noticeable way to the Arab world in the 1990s, especially after the mid 90s, 96, 97, 98. So that was past the Civil War. The Civil War ended 5 years earlier. So all my book is about the importance of what we call terrestrial television or broadcast television, and how actually, since I'm talking about the change, the shift in the relationship between television and audiences from one that was really disengaged with passive audiences and with television that didn't really care about so much the tastes and needs of the audiences, into audiences that were very active and that wouldn't, as one article put it, that wouldn't sit down or lay back and just take whatever was given to them, but they insisted to co-produce and to have an input into what they were shown on television. So from passive to active audiences, from disengaged to engaged television. So usually that dynamic in terms of Arab media, we place it after the beginning of the satellite television, you know, a decade later. But I see that it in Lebanon, it started since 1985 and even earlier with that relationship between television and audiences, where the audiences had a very significant part in the shift, because they went to great lengths to basically know, make their criticisms of television known. And specifically, they were using satire, mockery, and sarcasm. Let me give you a few examples of that, how the audiences became a major part and agent in that shift. For instance, their cynicism was very apparent in the language, in the special language, like the code language that they devised during the war. As I said, they really cared about knowing whether there is a kind of a problem outside, if there is danger. And since television didn't report much about that and didn't warn them, they developed these cold words. For example, expressions like mafishi, there is nothing. Basically, after the beginning of the war, no longer meant there is nothing. Now it meant the road is safe, keep going. You know, you can go wherever you want to go. And later that expression became even a sarcastic commentary on television. When there was a bloody battle, people would say, oh, mafishi, there is nothing. So they basically were, you know, mocking television. I think probably one of the most famous expressions like that was the so-called relative calm, hudu nisbi. That basically was used by television to mean that the number of the victims was not very high, so there is relative calm. And people were making fun of that expression sarcastically right and left. Even the poster child, the icon of Lebanese wartime culture, the very famous musician Ziad Rahbani, he wrote a whole song dedicated to that expression, and he called it relative calm. And it's very interesting. He shares that he wrote this during one time when the hostility stopped for a little bit, and so he, you know, he had a little like a calm moment. But what he produced, ironically, was a piece, just an instrumental, a piece without any language, which I think is a way, another commentary, sarcastic commentary on the fact that television, with its vocabulary and language, like relative calm, did not inform the audiences, did not do much to them. So language was totally meaningless for them. And the audiences also did the writers, especially, not just ordinary people, but also writers, they got involved into that debate. And in a lot of novels and memoirs, you will find pages, sometimes even whole sections of commentary about how television and radio as well, how they did not fulfill their duty during war times towards their audiences. Very famous writers such as Mahmoud Darwish, Huda Barakat, Rashida Daif, all of these people, they you know, mock television for the elusive, the evasive language. But the most important thing is that they portrayed in these novels how the audience really was craving for an intimate relationship with television and how the audiences were craving to be the new hero of television. So you'll find, for example, one short story where a television audience member, a young boy, is watching television, and then a girl, one of the characters there, is drowning in a river. And so he jumps inside the television to save her. And then basically he becomes the hero. You know, he's saving not just himself, not just like another person on a character on television, but he's saving television. And at the same time, he's saving the Lebanese public, because the major concern of the Lebanese public was safety. So he's saving the girl from dying, from drowning. To such degree that, for example, Mahmoud Darwish, the famous poet, at one point said that, you know, I want the show host who can basically make short speeches between my own words, between tapes of my own words. So you see how the audience envisioned itself as a very important major part of television. In other works, they envisioned how the broadcaster would call the television member, and the television member would start talking about his opinions and about everything. So that kind of foreshadows later the interest in reality television, in ordinary people, what they think, what they feel. So that started during the war period, and not 10 years later when we usually understand it. And as I said, periodicals also had a lot of criticism to say about television.
I think it would be interesting, sort of a comparative study on how the media landscape then in that Civil War was affected by and affected the war, and compare that to the Syrian Civil War now, where there's a totally different media landscape, to see, you know, comparing the effects. I think that might be pretty interesting.
I think this is a great idea. I think it's a great idea. And one thing I want to kind of respond to this suggestion is that during the Lebanese Civil War, the public, and especially these authors, these writers, and I guess the periodicals, just in total, the Lebanese audiences, we can't say that they were citizen journalists, because they never actually recorded events that happened and sent them to television stations to be broadcast. But what they did is they brought up the same types of questions that now we are considering with citizen journalists, how mainstream journalism, mainstream media, do not really portray the whole story, and how they cover up and sanitize all the news. And so when the Lebanese audiences were talking about these things, especially how safety was of grave concern to them, and how television and the media didn't really care about that and didn't, you know, care as much, that basically is the same concern of citizen journalists today, especially knowing that 90% of all the casualties are civilians in these conflicts.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So you mentioned a little bit already about what you used for your research. Are there any other resources you haven't mentioned yet that you used?
I used basically, so this is kind of the first lengthy study of television and war, and how these, you know, how the war affected television. But when you think of it, it was from 1975 to 1991. And so for me, it was, I guess, tackling such questions, especially in a time period, in earlier time period, requires using specific types of sources. And so what I used was interviews with employees in different television stations, oral interviews. And I also used a lot of written accounts, because these written accounts, especially accounts that came from that time period, including the popular press, popular magazines, daily, political dailies. I also used other types of recorded artifacts or sources from the war, such as, you know, sitcoms and drama series from the war. Mm-hmm. I used graphic novels, basically literature, the press, and also accounts by people that I interviewed. So these were kind of the major sources. But when you have sources, both written and oral, there's always the risk that you take the frame of that account to be the reality and not really put it under the microscope. And if there's time, I want to give you one or two examples. For example, this very famous anchor, Adel Malik, who was kind of describing his frustration in a whole book, but one quote specifically made an impression on me when he was talking that about the notorious bus incident, which I mentioned earlier. So he was like saying, when this happened, I tried to learn the truth, but I basically just saw a silence, a state of silence. And the hours were going by. It was going to be time very soon for me to get in front of the public and talk about the news. But I had nothing. I just had news about the Vietnam War, and I felt embarrassed. And I, you know, like I felt embarrassed as a professional. And so at the very last moment, I received a phone call, and they told me that, from the national news agency that collected the news, they told me that, there were some incidents in that area, but the responsible authorities are going to take care of it. They will launch an investigation. And so he says, like, you know, look, we were innocent. We were anchors, the agents of the bubble, but we were innocent. It was the national news agency. They are the ones to blame because they didn't give us the news. Mm-hmm. And basically, if you dig a little bit, further, this is a kind of a memoir, and memoirs have this quality of being kind of hagiographic accounts. Basically, they are accounts where people are looking to vindicate themselves, to excuse their earlier behavior, to paint it in a different picture, a much more positive picture. And so this also needs to be taken into account where you work with these kind of historical sources. Another example is that, as a whole, the audiences really romanticized their behavior. They portrayed themselves to be the new hero of television, and they are the one who suffered, and they were the victims, and television was the one who, you know, never said anything about the war, while at the same time, some of these audiences were militia members. Other people from the audiences, they were working with the militia members. They were lawyers, accountants, doctors that were servicing the militia members. And so this kind of a more romanticized account, it also needs to be put to be put in perspective that, you know, it's not the ultimate truth about what's going on.
Mm-hmm. What did you find that was most enjoyable in this research?
I think I had a lot of good moments and a lot of surprises on the way. One of them was that television was mocked and ridiculed all the time, that it failed the audiences. And people were talking that television, you know, oh, really, it tried to sell the audiences this lemon deal because, basically, because of the hostilities, a lot of the outside different forms of entertainment, they were destroyed, like theater, movie theaters were destroyed. So that, as an industry, kind of stopped for a while. You couldn't go out for concerts. You couldn't go out for walks or any other kinds of entertainment. So basically, there was kind of the deal. You know, we'll stay in, but you television are going to give us good programs. But television wasn't given good programs. You know, even entertainment programs were not very good because, you know, they couldn't go out and shoot new programs, new shows. they lost a lot of their budget, so they were showing reruns of older shows and, like, basically boring kind of programs. And so despite the fact that everybody was talking about the Lemon Deal and how this was bad, frequently, you know, the television audiences were actually interested in the programs that were shown. And one specific account was super interesting for me. This popular magazine talked in an article, it published a whole article on this case where a 70-year-old man and a 10-year-old boy got into a kind of a fight. And the fight ended up, it was about the fact that the older guy wanted to watch a satirical poetry competition. So in Lebanon, they have these, like, people who compose satirical poetry, and they kind of, like, invectives, they, you know, talk against each other. So they have this competition, almost like rap, but, yeah, you know, it's a form, a very ancient form, old form. And so the guy, the older guy, the grandpa wanted to watch that, but the grandson wanted to watch Little House on the Prairie. And so the dispute ended in the hospital because grandpa slammed the chair on the boy's head and then followed it with a plate of beans. And so that, what that shows, me is that, okay, there were boring programs and yet audiences were really fighting to watch certain events to the extent that, you know, grandpa would just slam a chair on his grandson's, head. So that was really interesting. To do. What was hard also to find is the actual bulletins from the war, because they didn't keep a record of them. They didn't keep a record of them, and from whatever they kept a record, now is not open for the general public, including for researchers. The only people who could actually go and look at the news record are people who are journalists that are employed in that station. So I made multiple attempts, but I couldn't get myself to actually view whatever they had, not the news bulletins, but other news-related shows. And so I used other accounts to understand how the audience saw that during the time. But I was able to get the sitcoms and the drama series on the black market, because they're popular even today. So people who work on that TV station, or even people at home, they kind of record them, and now they're on the black market, so I can access all of these shows.
Interesting. So what do you hope the book will do?
Well, first of all, I hope that the book is going to make the case for studying broadcast television, because in Arab media, which is a relatively newer field, we don't have as much research, and a lot of the research is kind of more of a compilations talking about Arab media just in general, instead of having detailed accounts about specific things and going deeper. So what I hope is for people to stop jumping from researching the Arab press and then jumping decades to Arab satellite television and completely forgetting about broadcast television. Broadcast television is relevant even today. There are multiple people who use it. Some people use it because it's the only available television for them. They cannot afford to pay the high price satellite packages. And it also is going to continue at least for another decade or even more, because it is the it is used for national emergency announcements. So it is supported. And it really made a difference in the life of Arab people. So I'm hoping through the case of Lebanon to make the case also for the study of terrestrial or broadcast television. And the other thing that I'm hoping is that that will somehow influence people to preserve the archive of Lebanese television. This is the oldest archive in the whole of the Arab world, television archive. It's 60 years old, and large chunks of it are being lost all the time because of administrative failure, because it is not really taken good care of. And it is really the cultural heritage, the cultural memory of the Lebanese people. And so I'm really hoping that this would somehow stimulate a conversation on how to preserve this archive and how to also open it for researchers so that they make it more relevant and so that people really have an incentive to preserve it and to use it and to shed some light on the history of Lebanese and Arab television.
Did you have any difficulties finishing the book or getting it published?
Publishing is always a long process, and I did have some difficulties in terms of getting permissions. I had no idea how many permissions I needed. And now I don't know if I will want to use the same type of things for my next books. But for example, one of the things that I needed permission was for the song lyrics. So I used some songs in the book. I basically quote them and then I analyze them. So I had to take permissions from the authors of the song, from the television station, and that took a long time. I had to take permissions also for all the epigraphs I used. And I used an epigraph for every single chapter. And now I'm thinking, next time I don't think I want to use epigraphs because that was a lot of work. And the other thing that was interesting was that we went through several different versions of how to, for the front cover. And finally, I hired two different artists to basically, I gave them a description of what I wanted on the cover, which was this dynamic. I don't know if you can see it here.
Yeah.
The dynamic between, the pretty television, the pretty liar, female anchor, and then the male audience member who does not pay attention to the war behind because she's putting these earphones on his head to keep him from, to keep him distracted. Yeah. And so this is what I, it took also a while to get to that version. So that was kind of some of the difficulties, and it made it a little longer, a few months longer. But overall, I was very happy with my editors, my acquisition editor, Alison Morachet, and my marketing editor, Lisa Kurbis, and a bunch of other people that worked with me. They were great.
Mm-hmm. Okay. What's your next writing project?
My next writing project is actually two things. One of them is I am writing a book about Arab atheists or apostasy in the Arab world. And the reason for that is that we have a whole new generation of Arabs that are seeing religion in a very different way. Usually what people, especially in the West, think is that, Arabs are born religious and they die religious and they never question religion and they, fight about religion. And here in Texas, for example, we get to hear Sharia law all the time, Sharia law this, Sharia law that. So there is kind of a misinformation in the general public about what Arabs, how contested religion is in the Arab world and how there is a whole new generation that is a lot less religious than what we are accustomed to seeing in the older generations. And so I'm trying to describe the kinds of struggle they have to go through in order to be public, in order to share publicly their accounts, in order to meet with other people who are not religious, and to create a community of people that could basically share the same interests. So that's one project. Another project is I am the lead co-author of an interdisciplinary book about refugees, and it touches on two different fields, critical animal studies and critical refugee and media studies, maybe, but critical refugee studies. So it's called, quote, like an animal, unquote, refugees, animals, and multiculturalism. So in this book, we are going to basically look at two groups. One is human refugees, and the other is non-human or animal animals who could be refugees or not. And so we will describe and analyze and compare how refugees are likened to animals and how animals are also being discriminated and oppressed in their own right. So we are combining these two fields to talk about migrations and the impact of that.
Is there anywhere that people can find your thoughts online? Do you have social media, web pages, anything like that?
I do have a Twitter account, and it is at Natalie_Cazale. Everything is lowercase. And on Facebook, I'm not very active there, but I will be. On Facebook, it's Natalie Lemon with two N's at the end.
Okay. All right. That's all the questions I have. Do you have any final thoughts or words?
I hope everybody will enjoy this program when they see it. And I want to thank you once again for this opportunity to talk about my work.
Okay. Yeah. Thank you. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
This podcast has been presented by War Scholar. Thank you for listening. Don't forget to visit warscholar.org or militaryhistorypodcast.com for more great interviews and military history information. Your visits help support this podcast. One of the best ways to provide feedback for this podcast is to rate me on iTunes. Please give me a good rating if you liked it, or feel free to give me a bad rating if you didn't. I'll use that feedback to make this a better podcast. You can also follow me on Instagram under Chris Alvarez War Scholar. That's Chris without an H, C-R-I-S. On Facebook under War Scholar. On YouTube under War Scholar 1945, and on Twitter under War Scholar. Thank you, and I hope you return to this podcast for more great military history.